Hello again. Welcome back to the second part of the lecture series on nanotechnology in solar cells. We will be covering light trapping scenarios today. We'll start with flat solar cells, and then we'll move on to investigating light trapping in two-dimensional and three-dimensional solar cells. And we'll also investigate a couple of examples from literature, a couple of papers from literature. Yes, flat solar cells. The first thing that can come to our mind will be the anti-reflection coating. The anti-reflection coating, as we discussed in the first part of the lectures, is used to decrease the reflection. It's here, as you can see. At the particular wavelength, right at that point, our reflection is almost equated to zero. This ARC, the thickness of the ARC, which is a zinc oxide layer, is fixed to be 60 nanometers, while the absorber layer thickness is very, let's call that T for the time being. As you can see, we have different parameters for that, starting from 60 nanometers, going up to 500 nanometers. As the absorber thickness is increased, the reflections will be decreased. And that's what we see in the graphs. TMM is a commonly used method. Its long name is transfer matrix method, and HFSS is a numerical tool that we use. It's a conversion tool, electromagnetic solver. Why does the absorption decrease as we increase the absorber thickness? Well, basically, metal likes to shine the light back, reflect back. If we have more absorber there, of course, will our bandwidth or the reflective properties will be altered and our reflection coefficients will be decreased. As you can see, the pink one has the widest bandwidth. If we go here, we already sorted out an approximate formula for the quarter wave thickness, the thickness of this ARC. If we plug that in, and please refer back to the first lecture there for the quarter wavelength matching. If you plug in our formula, we come to the wavelength, the corresponding wavelength for the for this matching to occur, which is around 500 nanometers. Of course, these are real dielectric parameters with N and K values that we also discussed in the first lecture. What I mean by that is zinc oxide and the PBS layers, they are modeled with their actual parameters. So it's not going to be an exact number, but it's going to be close to 500 nanometers. And that's where we find our reflection zero point as well. And now we can continue with the Fabry-Perot resonances. Okay, let's think about this other cell. We have a dome structure, as you can see, and this is very commonly used in solar cells. Let's call this T1, the thickness of the flat part of the absorber, and there is a TCO layer. As I told you in the first lectures, TCO is transparent zinc conductive oxide, and we selected zinc oxide for that purpose. Let's call this the height of the dome and the radius of the dome, and the period is given with L. Of course, we have a metal at the bottom, so we're really working with it. We are working with a real solar cell at this point. Let's look at the reflection properties of the cell. So, what we're prompted with is this graph. But what can be the source of these peaks? Now we'll start investigating these. All right. So, as you might remember, reflection is something really unwanted, and we want to minimize it as much as possible. Of course, we'll never have a broadband reflection-free solar cell as good as that, but we'll try to minimize it as much as possible. These parameters are corresponding to the radius and the height of the dome. And of course, the periodicity is given as 500 nanometers. Okay, so let's first change the periodicity. Let's plug in two different numbers, L equals 200 and L equals 800 nanometers. As you can see, there is a resemblance here, at least for a certain part of the band, wavelength region, and it's this region. So what can be the source of that resemblance? Then, another thing commonly employed is to plot the flat cell response in the same on the same graph. The flat cell has no dome, so let me just briefly draw it for you. So instead of the dome, we have three layers. The metal here again, the absorber layer which was PBS, and the zinc oxide here as well. And we keep the flat layer thicknesses the same. So it used to be 500 nanometers for the zinc oxide layer, 100 nanometers for the PBS layer, and 50 nanometers for the metal, gold. So again, it's strikingly similar, this part. The rest is a little different. So we're going from this to that and to this. So what can be the source of this resemblance? If we take a close look, the flat case, which is this green one, and the red one, they resemble the most in comparison to the other. And the worst one is, of course, the blue one. Blue one does not even give the same ringings that we see for the other, for the rest, the three other structures. So apparently, then we can sort out the reason for these reflection peaks. It's coming from the Fabry-Perot. We covered the Fabry-Perot in the first series, so in the first lecture. Please again refer back to those notes. You'll see that for just these slabs like these, there's a Fabry-Perot resonance, and it's coming into picture in that wavelength spectrum. So which slab is playing a major role in that certain wavelength region? Again, we have the HFSS, the conventional software, and TMM transfer matrix results together. They are converging to each other, which means that we are doing it right. We're simulating our structures in the correct way. So we can define two regions here, region 1 and region 2. We were particularly interested in region 1, and the resonances, Fabry-Perot resonances, were apparent there. So these are the responses of the flat cells, so we don't have dome structures in these for these graphs. So in the first structure here, in A, our T1 is doubled. So we're keeping the zinc oxide thickness the same, 500 nanometer, but we're doubling our T1. As you can see, it has no effect here in region 1, so it just keeps the same. But it affects, comes into play in the second band. Let's go down. In the second example, we're doing just the opposite. Now we're fixing the thickness of the first layer, T1, and we are changing the thickness of the second layer. And we are first doubling it and then decreasing it, dividing it by itself. So what do we get? We see that the number of the modes here change drastically when we change the thickness of the layer. So we arrive at a solution. It means that within this region, it's zinc oxide that is the dominant slab layer within that wavelength spectrum. And the Fabry-Perot results dictate that for the first region, we can again apply that simple formula that we sorted out, and it will approximately give us similar results. We will approximately find out the number of modes, number of M's. If we double the thickness, if we increase that by 2 times, of course the number of the modes will be increased by 2. So let's investigate that scenario. So from the green one to the black one, as you can see here, the number of demotes will be increased. So we just have one mote here within that spectrum for the green one, but for the black one, we have two, as you can see. So the number of modes are increased. Likewise, when we switch it up to 1000, the number of modes will be multiplied by 4. This time we will have more modes. In the second part of the domain, both of the slabs are coming into picture, and we can express it roughly like this. Again, an important remark. So these formulas are valid up to some degree because there are losses. Our fabric-parallel problem is not as easy as this. There are losses involved here. We're using actual parameters of the materials, so it will be a little different than what we found in the first lecture. Okay, so can we optimize the performance of this device by playing around with fabric-parallel resonances? Yes, definitely. So let's say that this is the cutoff wavelength of PBS. We found out in the first lecture, we discussed in the first lecture that the absorbers have certain cutoff wavelengths. Their absorber strength will be sustained up to that point. More than that, their absorption will not be that much important, that much significant. All right. So I just randomly put it to that point, so it's not an exact cutoff wavelength for that specific absorber. And the absorber cutoff wavelengths will be different for every absorber. As you can see, if we somehow, so this is the original case, it's still inside the cutoff wavelength. If we somehow shift it to the other side, like that, as you can see in the red one, it's shifted so that it's outside of the cutoff wavelength, then it will not create a big problem for us. The reflection peak will be pushed outside of the cutoff wavelength. But of course, there's a trade-off the engineer must take into consideration. Here, the red gives more reflection. And on the other hand, here, the blue one gives more reflection. So the JSC, the short circuit current values, will be very useful for this kind of a comparison. The one with more JSC, more short circuit current, will give us a better device. And these are the optimized cells. These cells have, this time, domes. And as you can see, we have defined the periodicities, the corresponding periodicities, and the height and the radius of the domes are listed there. So, as you might recall, we had all those ringings in that part, but now we canceled them out, and we have a better reflection for these cells. What do? We kill the Fabry-Perot ringings, that's our strategy. And we try to shift the Fabry-Perot peaks outside of the cutoff wavelength. But the Fabry-Perot peaks do not necessarily have to be bad thing for a solar cell. Every Fabry-Perot peak is followed by a Fabry-Perot dip. And we try to pull it into our absorbing regime as much as possible. So we'd like to make use of these Fabry-Perot dips as much as possible as well. But of course, Fabry-Perot does not allow us to modulate the reflection parameters a lot. Once we have a dip, likewise, we'll have a peak as well. So the best strategy will be to kill the Fabry-Perot rings as much as possible. So the L equals L touch case was one of the best that we had in our results. L equals L touch case is now this one here, L equals 300 nanometer. An helical's 400 nanometer is not that far away from that structure. Why did I say it like that? Because I know that the radius of the dome is 150 nanometer. So the diameter will be 150 nanometers. So that's the condition where the dome edge is touching the boundary of the unit cell. But why does it give the best performance? Let's compare it again with the flat cell. So these are the plane waves. You might remember them. So light is coming in like that. So this is our TCO. This is a thick TCO, as you can see. The light is propagating inside TCO without any problem because it is transparent and it reaches the PBS, the absorber, and then starts getting absorbed. On the other hand, here we have a dome structure. We can couple more light into the absorber this time. How? By nanolensing. That is another thing we covered in the first lectures. We can couple more light into it, and we could also do focusing inside the nanodome if it is possible. So that will decrease the reflection parameters drastically. Okay, the advantages of using nanodome are these. So we increase the optical length. What do we mean by that? The light will not just go directly to the metal, but it will be bent. Its trajectory will be significantly higher than the trajectory of the light that is propagating inside the flat cell. So if you add more trajectory, then immediately you have a better chance of absorbing more and more light. The other thing, as we discussed, we are shaping the wavefronts. The incoming wavefronts are bent, and that enables coupling into the structure more efficiently. And we are also doing focusing. But the disadvantage is that we are increasing the absorber, the total absorber volume that we're using, apparently. So it was just this much here, but we're almost using the whole volume in there, excluding the zinc oxide material that's surrounding the dome. So that's a little bit costly. So the engineer has to come to an optimization between the two. But still, it is better than the flat cell. How do we know that? We work with the same effective thickness. So the corresponding effective thickness will be around this much for the flat cell. How do I know that? How did I come to that conclusion? Well, the total volume inside this whole domain, let's call it V, of course it's going to be more than the total volume occupied by PBS here. All we need to find is this total height, so that once it's multiplied by this area here, it will give us the same volume. So we need to find the H value geometrically so that it will work at the same effective thicknesses to make a fair comparison. And once we do that, we see that the flat layer can only absorb 30 milliamperes, while the dome structure makes it jump to 37. Okay, so these are different lenses. It's always good to have something around L equals L touch condition, because there will always be fabry-perry ringings coming from the sides here and there. So that's one thing we should always keep in mind. And a high aspect ratio will of course be better. Why? We are, as you can see, again, increasing the optical path of the incoming light, and we'll have more opportunity, we'll create more opportunities for it to be absorbed. But of course, at a certain point, this aspect ratio comes to a saturation, so we don't need to increase it indefinitely. But apparently, as you can see, this much of focusing may not be enough, so this gives us a better result. Okay, so let's continue with the comparison between substrate and superstrate configurations. In some cases, the researchers may build superstrate, and in some others, they will build substrate configurations. When you go to the clean room, you'll build your solar cell on a glass or a substrate. In this case, we're shining the light from top, and our substrate structure is underneath the solar cell. On the other hand, for the superstrate configuration, it's just the opposite. Our superstrate is at the top. But again, the two layers are seeing, the light will be seeing the same amount of layers. So as you can see, it first sees AZO, aluminum zinc oxide, and titanium oxide, and it's going to see the same amount of aluminum zinc oxide and titanium oxide in the other case. So, we already know the result here. We know that the flat layer's reflection parameters will be worse than the domes. So immediately we can tell that this will be better, at least in a certain frequency or a wavelength region. And we'll discuss that. When we look at the absorption of the crystalline silicon, we see that the superstrate is fairly doing much better than the substrate is doing much better than the superstrate structure. This yellow one is the Yablanovich limit, and we'll discuss that in details in a few slides. So this short wavelength superiority of the substrate is totally associated with the dome structure, the dome's reflection properties over the flat layers. And we already covered that in the first series of lectures by investigating the MOTHI. Okay, let's take a look at this. AZO was the first layer that the light saw. AZO, as you can see, has a high dielectric, imaginary dielectric part in that region from 300 to 400. Likewise, crystalline silicon also has a high dielectric constant, imaginary part there. But since AZO is the first layer, AZO will absorb the majority of the incoming light. So crystalline silicon will not see that much of light within that region from 300 to 400. But after that, luckily, our AZO is all transparent, almost transparent. And its dielectric parameter, imaginary part of it, is almost zero. So from that point on, from 400 nanometers, the light will be reaching crystalline silicon. So here is what's happening. This is the flat case. Light is coming from here. As you can see, it is reaching crystalline silicon, but not that effectively. On the other hand, light is also coming from top this time, and we're looking at the intensity values. As you can see, light was coupled much more efficiently than the flat structure, and we see that it penetrated more than the flat case. And that explains the mystery that's happening at short wavelengths. So, in summary, at short wavelengths, the performance of the first layers are very important. You have to choose your TCO as a transparent layer, as the name implies. And as the second thing, the curvature is extremely important. As you can see, if we have a flat layer, it doesn't work that good. You need to have something with a curvature, a dome basically. And you mustn't leave lots of sides here. So that's why this dome is almost touching the boundary of the unit cell. If it doesn't, then we'll converge more and more to the flat cell. And the third thing, we need a good aspect ratio. Those three things must be sustained. And that's another wavelength. It's the same thing happening. The coupling is much better and efficient for the crystalline silicon when it has a dome instead of a flat cell. Okay, now we move on to Yablonovich limits. I showed you Yablonovich limit on a graph, but now we're discussing it for the first time. Yablonovich, in 1982, published a paper on statistical ray optics, and he said that if light is emerging from top, the portion that is inside this cone, he called them the radiative modes, can leak out easily, but the maximum amount of the light that can be absorbed by an absorber with a refractive index of n is this much. I won't go into the details of the derivation, but we can visualize it like this. This theta value is the maximum angle that Snell's law will still hold without total internal reflection. In other words, the light will be leaking away, will be able to leak away if this theta angle is smaller than the this cone's angle. So those angles that reside inside the cone will be leaking away. Other ones will be absorbed. That's what Yablonovich proposed. So he, in a way, theoretically formulated the highest absorption that can be achieved by an absorber with straightforward methods, not really including plasmonics, diffractions, and others. But for slab, this is the case. If we have a light incident I, and the portion that stays inside the radiator most, let's call it R, and let's minimize the reflections, let's say that it's zero, the one R minus I minus R will become R absorption. So he said that the portion that is not inside that cone will be totally absorbed. So that gives us a limit. A good limit, though. That's like the maximum amount of absorption that an absorber can achieve. Somewhere at least close to that. So now let's investigate different absorbers. Amorphous silicon, cadmium threonide, and crystalline silicon. They're labeled with three different colors. From 400 to 1500, we have more than 50 milliamps to harvest. I mean, the light will be coming into these absorbers, and if they can absorb throughout this spectrum from 400 to 1500, the total light that they can harvest will be converted to milliamperes current, and that will be the summation of these two values. But as you can see, amorphous silicon, cadmium threonide, and crystalline silicon, their absorption strength all ends at a certain point. And that's the cutoff wavelength I was talking about. So as you can see, amorphous silicon dies out even before 750 nanometers here, whereas cadmium threonide falls around 850, and crystalline silicon falls around 1050 nanometers. So if you look at it, amorphous silicon. For amorphous silicon, the short wavelength response is very critical. How did we define the short wavelength? From 400 to 600 nanometers, we define it to be the short wavelength. Within that spectrum, amorphous silicon, if it works well, it can harvest 11.84 milliamperes. Once it leaves that 600 nanometers, it has only about 7 milliamperes to harvest. And it won't really harvest that much of the light, incoming light. So, likewise, we'll carry out the same analysis for different absorbers in the next slide. Let's go to the next slide. Amorphous silicon, the first material that we are studying. So this is the solar spectrum that we discussed in the first lecture. As you can see, going from 250 nanometers up to 2000 nanometers, the absorption spectrum of amorphous silicon does not change a lot. So it's just this much of change. If you build up a really bad absorber, then your absorption might drop down to this. So these are all Yablonovich curves. And Yablonovich curve all depends on the thickness of the slab here that we have, the flat slab. But using that, we're like approximating the behavior of a bad and a good cell. In this case, the cyan color here approximates a bad cell, solar cell. Let's take a look at the results. So, a solar cell that's not really optimized and that corresponds to a flat cell of 25 nanometers, which is very small, will give us around 14 milliamperes, which is still good. And if we go from 250 nanometers to 1000 nanometers, let's say, we just gain like 1 milliamperes. So there is not really much room for amorphous silicon to play around at longer wavelengths. What I mean by that is, there is not really much for amorphous silicon to harvest from 600 to 700 nanometers. It's just around 1 nanometer. Even if we improve our solar cell to work much better. So we arrived to the conclusion that amorphous silicon is a short wavelength governed cell. It's going to be most likely like the case in your designs. So when we think about short wavelength response, a good short wavelength response, a couple of slides back, we already covered that. We need L around L touch, and we need a curvature, a good curvature, and a good aspect ratio. So let's now switch to crystalline silicon. Crystalline silicon is quite different than amorphous silicon because, as you can see, from the yellow one to the others, we still have an improvement. If we look at it from the worst cell, which is 25 nanometers, okay, it's a very thin cell and it can just mimic a bad solar cell made out of crystalline silicon. From that to 1000 nanometer, we have a jump of 12, which is a rather large number. So, in summary, in contrast to amorphous silicon, crystalline silicon has a lot to cover here, has lots of opportunities. So, we'll call it a long wavelength dominated absorber for that reason. And if we go to cadmium threonite, you see that cadmium threonite cells, their response will not change a lot, even if we go from the yellow one to the others. So even if you don't do a good job, then you'll arrive at 22 milliamperes. And it's not that bad as if you compare it with the other results of crystalline silicon. So from 250 nanometers to 1000, you again gain around 1 milliamperes. They all follow the same trajectory up to 800 nanometer. So the short wavelength response for cadmium threonide should be redefined. The short wavelength response is now shifted from 600 nanometers to 800 nanometers because all of those cells are doing a good job till 800 nanometer. What do I mean by that? Well, cadmium threonide, in comparison to the other cells, let's go a couple of slides back. In comparison to amorphous silicon, for example, or crystalline silicon, does not have this kind of a slope, but it falls immediately, loses the absorption strength quite suddenly. But till that point, till 800 nanometers, the absorber is doing a good job and already absorbing most of the light. So cadmium threonide is a short wavelength response absorber, and again the short wavelength restrictions need to be taken care of. Okay, then we covered the short wavelength responses. Now let's move on to the long wavelength region. At short wavelengths, the absorbers are dominantly very powerful, and we don't really need lots of trapping techniques. If we have a good dome structure, like we emphasized over and over again, then our job will be done almost. So, but at higher wavelengths, longer wavelengths, this is not really true. We need to apply a couple of light trapping techniques by making use of other physics. Okay, we covered this in the previous lecture. This is a slab, and when we shine it from the side, as you can see, we will have even and an odd mode. Those are the waveguided modes, and that's our air line as we defined last time. The modes cannot go outside of this. They will be guided through the waveguide, just like the same picture we've shown last time. But what happens if we divide that waveguide and make it discontinuous? Then it becomes something like a photonic crystal, if you remember. But different than that, our photonic crystal was true for a two-dimensional photonic crystal. The periodicity was extending in both directions. But in this case, it is not really periodic in this Z direction. So what's going to happen? We will have Bloch modes, very similar to the ones that we had for the photonic crystals. By the way, we called them even and odd modes. What do we mean by that? Is there is a parity with respect to Z axis. If the mode is has the same parity on plus C and minus C, we call it even. If it doesn't, we call them odd. As you can see, the Bloch modes are periodic. They show periodic electric fields. You can easily calculate dispersion graphs. We did something similar last time, but the photonic crystals that we studied last time did not have an air line. Why do we need an air line this time? Well, again, the Bloch mode will be traveling along tangential components, and it needs to stay inside the air cone. So what's happening? If we get the dispersion curve of a waveguide, without the grating here, we will be able to extend these lines like that. Those should be familiar, relatively flat lines that we covered for waveguides. But once we define a periodicity and a photonic crystal in that periodicity, then we have a crystal structure, a unit lattice, just like the way we discussed last time. And at the boundary of the unit lattice, the dispersion curve will not get extended. The K vectors cannot take all the values that we desire, but will be folded back into the crystal. And another thing that should be familiar with you starts happening. So we get these small bands, as you can see. Those are small forbidden bands we discussed. So this was the case for the waveguide with a small grating on the top. We can also have a grating made out of zinc oxide, TCO material. But once we put that, we need to also put the zinc oxide cone. And the modes that are residing underneath the zinc oxide cone will be the guided modes. So drastically, we're losing the number of modes we can work with. As you can see in the previous slide, we could make use of all these other modes or bands, but at this time, we can only work with these. And one other thing, the dispersion curves that you see here are almost touching to each other. That wasn't really true for the other type of grating made out of absorber. This grating is made out of zinc oxide. Because of the lower dielectric constant of this grating, now we don't really see the formation of those small band gaps, but just straight lines. That was one detail. And of course, we can also have a dispersion graphs for these two. Now we have a very similar thing, the combination of the two worlds. We have a TCO, but we also made a grating out of our absorber too. So we lost lots of modes by putting the TCO on the top last time because we also had the zinc oxide curve line. Now, by putting the making the grating out of the crystalline silicon, the absorber, with a higher dielectric constant, we are at least collecting some of those modes back. So if you compare the two slides, let's go one slide back. And again, so you see, you're gaining a couple of modes that we can work with. So all those bands have different Bloch modes residing. Okay, so that's what I tried to mean in the last slide. If we continue with the K vectors, if we scan along gamma x, it's going to be a symmetrical structure, unlike the waveguide structure. For the waveguide structures, it used to be straight going into infinity. It could get every K it wanted. But in this case, for our photonic crystals, it can't take all those K values. It needs to stop at an exact location at the crystal corner. And once we collect the modes, the Flocke Bloch modes, on those bands, we end up with these kind of modes. So I would just like you to keep in mind the shapes of these modes. As you can see, these modes can reside, they don't really prefer a certain part. They can reside in different parts of the absorber. So this one resided more and more in the flat part. This preferred the grating, for example. They are all called Bloch modes of this kind of a grating. So we are now working with gratings, but we can always think them or imagine them to be our good old domes in our mind. They're like a projection or an abstraction to simplify the things and to investigate the physics in an easier way. And here we have a different mode. So now we zoomed out all the way. Our structure is just in the middle. So we are looking at a rather large structure, rather large domain, I mean. The air, electric fields are localized in the air, as you can see, and we don't have a mode inside the slab. This is an air mode. This is an air mode. It is coupled to one of these flow cap modes that we are working with that resides in air. And as you can see, it's not under the air line, so it's not coupled to the flow cap blow modes of the structure. Okay, so now we start diffractionating wave guiding. Again, we start with the small grating structure. At normal incidence, we have seen in the last lecture that we could convert that into a tangential component. The incident light did not have a tangential component, but we still have a tangential component in the end coming from the grating. So this portion will be zero. Why? Because phi is equal to zero. We are coming at normal incidence. Nevertheless, we still have a tangential component, k2 times sine theta, equal to multiple integers of 2 pi over L. Okay, and if we study that case, the normal incidence case, for the waveguide structure, we already calculated the dispersion curves for the waveguide, and we discussed that in the first part of the lecture series. We are now mixing it with another thing, with the fraction lines that we covered in the isofrequency contours in the first lectures. So now we have a tangential component kx of this much. And this is the first diffraction order. This is the second diffraction order. It has a kx of that much. You know how to calculate their total amount. They will be equal to 2 pi over Lm for the square lattice diffraction grating, such as we have shown in the last slide. So the tangential components must be equal, and the tangential component corresponding to the diffraction order here are meeting at a certain point, and that will bring a mode. Likewise, the diffraction line crosses the dispersion curves at a secondary point, and a third one, a fourth, and two others here. If you calculate the frequencies corresponding to those intersection points, we have six modes in the end. So what we are assuming? We are assuming a perturbation. We already calculated the dispersion curve for the slab mode. Then we are adding a small grating on the top. And we're saying that with this additional grating, we are giving a tangential component, but it is so small that it will not perturb the dispersion graph of the slab of the flat layer itself, and it will just add those tangential components and will intersect them with the dispersion curves to match the tangential component of the wave vectors. Okay, but we could also look at the transmission of the of such a structure. So there's another thing that we can do. We can apply the electric field from the top to the same structure with the grating. And at those points where we convert it to the tangential component, we'd like to see a drop. And exactly, we see these drops at these locations. So the electric field that is launched from this side is not transmitted well to the other side, but the incoming energy, electromagnetic wave energy, is converted to a tangential electromagnetic energy so that the transmission is rather bad. The red one and the green ones, they correspond to the transmission of the flat layers without the grating. And the blue one here has the grating with a thickness of 20 nanometers. So this is 20 nanometers. And this total flat layer underneath is 200 nanometers. So these sudden drops must correspond to the waveguided modes, the modes that are guided inside the slab. We also have low transmission at other sides as well, and a high transmission likewise. Those are the Fabry-Perot rings that we already know for the slabs, for the flat slabs. Okay, now let's take a look at these modes, and we immediately find these results. For 100 terahertz, 200 terahertz, there was nothing special going on. For 100 terahertz, we were close to the transmission minimum point, and at 200 terahertz, we were close to transmission maximum point. So it is portrayed here. We have more electric field at the input side, so which in other words means that we have more reflection. And likewise, for 200 terahertz, we have more electric field at the output side, more transmission, and less reflection. But at 280 terahertz, we'd start to see something. That's light trapping. At that value, we see a tiny drop. That part of the incoming electric power, electromagnetic power, is converted to the horizontal direction. Likewise, we see the appearance of different modes here. The reflection coming from the third mode here is pretty bad. You see, we have lots of reflection at the input side. But still, we have a very good confinement of the electric field inside the slab. Okay. And we also can count the number of peaks. So this has only one peak here. This other one has two. The other one has three. So these are the first, the second, and the third modes. And the fourth one has a little different feature. So it's not really resembling the others. So this is another mode, but this is coming from the second order diffraction. So it's not coming from the same line. This is coming from the second order diffraction. This also is coming from the second order diffraction. That's the reason why they don't look like the others. Where this is again from the first order diffraction, and it looks similar to the others in the previous slide, we can count four modes here. And this was just an arbitrary frequency. Okay, so we trapped really six modes at desired locations, and we have justified that our small perturbation analysis works, because when we try to see the transmission curve of the light inside through this grating, we verified that we could capture the light at around the frequencies that we expected from the simple analysis. What happens when we put a TCO on the top and the grating is made out of TCO? Okay, again, a very similar problem. We lose some of the modes because we now have to work again underneath the zinc oxide curve. and that restricts us. But still, we have three modes coming from the first order diffraction line. From the second order, we have two. This time, we have five modes totally. My resonances and light trapping. Another strategy to trap the light is my resonances. We already discussed how my resonances work. We said that if the radius of a small scatterer is on the order of the wavelength of the light that's emerging, it will just scatter the light. But in the meantime, it may also encapsulate the light and cause a resonance. And likewise, just as an example, we put a sphere and look at the resonance conditions for that sphere. At the resonance condition, of course, the absorption will get its peak value. And these are like resonance conditions. And the only thing that's changing here is the periodicity, L, the separation between the spheres. And as you can see, we can clearly identify the my mode here, for example. There is nothing underneath. There's air, a sphere that is embedded in AZO, welcomes the incoming light, and my mode is excited inside that nanocrystalline nanowire. Okay. So what happens when it encapsulates that incoming light? So this is the case without a slab. So there is nothing underneath. It's all air again. And the structure is once again embedded inside the TCO material, AZO. Once that is the case, if we just put a slab, a crystalline silicon slab underneath, we see that the encapsulated mode is also present here, but there might be a chance for it to couple the light into the silicon slab. So it's like the diffraction, but it's not doing any trick on the tangential components, but the leakage will couple into the slab. Likewise, if we just eliminate the sphere here without the slab and with the slab, we can couple the light into the slab. And this will, of course, be for our advantage. That's where the hybridization comes into picture. Okay. So let's investigate this problem. Without these nanowires on the top, we just have a flat layer and a flat AZO on the top. And that corresponds to the absorption of this blue curve here. Here we have the Yablanovich limit for crystalline silicon. As soon as we place this nanowire in the top, we achieve those peaks. And we'll discuss every one of those. The only difference between the two is this insertion into the flat absorber, and that I call T. In this case, it's just inserted by 5 nanometers. This case, it's inserted more, 20 nanometers. As you can see, there is nothing drastically changing in between the two. Okay, let's investigate the first mode. The light is emerging, and we see that the nano wire on the top is enabling a coupling mechanism so that the slab layer underneath is able to excite the available modes, and that maximizes the absorption. Here, we have no hybridization. What I mean by that is there is no my resonance coupling into the available modes of the slab underneath. But this is truly coming from the diffraction phenomena that we just discussed. This is a wave-guided mode, just like one of those we have seen in the previous slides. And the nanowire this time is working like a grating, and it excites the available mode inside the slab. In the third mode, this is a photonic crystal Bloch wave mode. It is a periodic mode available inside these periodic structures, something similar to the electric field distributions we discussed in the earlier slides. And this one is a MIME mode. How do I know that it's a MIME mode immediately? Well, once we eliminate the sphere, only sphere, we already see this mode inside. And when we put the slab underneath, we see that there's a small peak appearing, and which is absent for the flat layer. That means that this mode is getting coupled to this flat slab, and that's increasing the absorption a little bit. Okay, so what happens when we decrease the radius of the nanowire? Once we do this, we lose some of the opportunities for light trapping. Why? Because basically bigger domes will have bigger density of states. What do I mean by that? Well, bigger domes, instead of these small domes, will have larger probability to encapsulate higher order MIME modes, which can be important for us. And as you can see, some of the modes are not listed here for the pink colored curve. And that's for the small dome case. And again, the small domes also don't show the photonic crystal modes that easily, and that's another disadvantage. So we are sacrificing from the MIME modes, the Bloch waves, and that's the result of the absence of those modes. We see smaller absorption, totally. Okay, so what happens if we increase the period here? For this case, once we increase the period, we bring in more modes, and that's also increasing our absorption, total absorption. So how can we explain this? We can explain it depending on the simple formulations that we covered in previous slides. So let's say that we initially started here, and our diffraction line will be at 2 pi over L1. That's the first diffraction order. By increasing L, we're basically shifting it to here, to another location. And then we are able to play with other diffraction orders too. For this case, once we touch the crystalline silicon air cone, we won't see other diffraction orders. So the second order was not existent there. But now, once we shift it to this other location, the second order mode may come into the picture. So we are, in a way, increasing the density of states for our slab by increasing the periodicity. Likewise, if we decrease the period here, then we are sacrificing some of the modes, and that becomes the cyan colored curve, and we are losing many of those modes and decreasing the absorption. And how does the waveguide thickness affect all of these? Well, once again, the thickness of the waveguide is a determining factor for the density of states that we can harvest to absorb the light, to couple the light. If we decrease that, let's say to its half value, we will again sacrifice many of those modes, and we see that we're losing several of those peaks. The slab is in a way an ocean, giving us the available modes that we can, in which we can trap the light. We can trap it by using my modes, waveguided modes with the diffractions, or with hybridization scenarios, and also playing with block waves. So by making it half of its size, we're losing some of those modes. And you can easily visualize it like this. Let's again think about the dispersion curve. Let's say that this is the case, this is the dispersion curve for the half size slab, T over 2 case. If we had a thicker one, we would increase the number of modes here, the number of available modes. And likewise, we would be able to couple to them much more efficiently. Okay, so that was the part that we worked with nanowires. Now we switch back to domes, nanodomes. And this is the case we're working with. The flat cell for the comparison purposes and the nanodome structure in an hexagonal lattice. A hexagonal lattice is preferred because it has the highest density of packaging. So you see that we have selected three wavelengths to work with, to study. The red one has a thicker ARC, anti-reflection coating, in contrast to the blue one. And hence, it's working worse. But if we look at the dome structure, it's just outweighing the others. And now let's go to those lines, those wavelengths, B, C, and D. B, let's remind ourselves, is at the corner of the short wavelength spectrum that we discussed, while C and D reside in the long wavelength part. So you would immediately appreciate the power of the nanodome. Once we compare the pictures, the electric field is much more localized and coupled into the dome structure in comparison to the flat layers. So this is the shortest wavelength, the corner of the short wavelength spectrum, which was B, C, and D, if we name them like that. Well, B, in B, we have just lensing effect, if you see. We have a very well-focused light. Our absorber is quite strong, and it's focusing it at the midpoint. Whereas in C and D, we have hybridization effects. So in C and D, we have bioresonances and photonic crystal block wave modes hybridized to the available modes of the flat slab underneath. And let's investigate the last scenario, the plasmonics. We could also add a plasmonic structure to this, and we could also study what we would gain out of that. So once we add the backscatters, the silver backscatters, as you can see, this dome does not have those scatters, while this dome does. That scatterer come into picture at longer wavelengths, and plasmonics modes, the surface modes that we discussed, the surface plasma polaritons are seen, are witnessed on the surface of the metals, which is not apparent in the other graph for the dome without the backscatters. Well, if we look back, if you go one slide back, we see that the plasmon effects, the surface plasmon polaritons enable absorption much further. Why? Because we have surface attached waves now, and they're helping us to first scatter the light with the nanodomes and then absorb it even more while those surface waves are propagating. But there is a disadvantage of the plasmonic structures as well, at least for the silver. Just like the way we covered in the previous lecture, the plasmonic structures, they can also introduce losses. So let's draw the AG silver nanodomes again inside the big nanodome, larger nanodome. Okay, at some point there might be surface plasmon polariton action, and that's going to help us. But another wavelength, at the smaller wavelength, the metal will start acting like a dielectric material and will lose the surface plasmon polaritons, and that will introduce further losses. And that this explains the degrading effect for the blue curve in contrast to the dome that doesn't have the plasmonic structures. Okay, and let's start investigating the papers that we have in the literature. The first one, the Mie resonances. So this paper starts by investigating two spheres that are shown in B and E. As you can see, it has two Mie resonance modes appearing at 610 and 500 nanometers, and they are shown on this graph. These are the two points here, N equals 1 and N equals 2, designated number of modes. And once we put a slab, just like we did in our discussions, underneath that nanosphere, for this case, there is a tiny bit of leakage into the sphere, into the slab. Once we put the cylinder, a pillar, on top of the slab layer, that's the perspective, then it can leak, can introduce a leaky channel into the substrate, and that increases the overall absorption. So by doing that, we are sacrificing these nice Mie modes that are maximizing the scattering cross section, but in contrast, we are broadening the absorption, overall absorption. So, in other words, this, as in the case of the sphere, is no longer a good cavity. The nanocylinders are not as good cavities as the nanospheres, but they leak the captured the trapped light into the slab underneath and making it a more broadband absorber, which outweighs the opportunities that we can get with a nanosphere. Okay, we can also put a ARC too on top of that. So this is a bare silicon, and this is the silicon after the ARC coating. As you can see, it got darker because its reflection properties are enhanced. Lower reflection means darker images. And this is an FESEM photo at 40 degrees, and that's the top view. They manufactured these nanocylinders, and here are the results that they get. But once we introduce the nanopillars, the nanocylinders, we decrease the overall reflection. And at certain points, those Mie resonance points, we have a lower reflection. As you can see, the smaller diameters of nanopillars are coming from the smaller diameters to the larger diameters, 250 nanometers, we are getting a redshift as expected. That's a common response of the MyResonance. The bigger nanospheres or nano cylinders, they get their MyResonance at longer wavelengths, and that's causing the redshift. And what can we do? Well, in this portion, we weren't really able to touch that portion. The reflection properties wasn't really altered with the introduction of the nanopillars. Once we put the anti-reflection coating layer on top of the nanopillars, it's really decreasing further the overall reflection. And if you take a look at the thickness, T equals 50 nanometers thickness of the anti-reflection, we get the minimum amount of reflection. The total reflection is now 1.8%, and we're coming from 36.6% to 1.8%. That's a big change. The anti-reflection coating is of course tuned to this wavelength spectrum, so that's why it's doing its job very good within that spectrum. After 800 nanometers, we're not really seeing any MyResonance, but from the flat layer to these lower reflections, we immediately come to the conclusion that the My scatterers are doing their job. They're not capturing the incoming light this time, but they're scattering the light pretty good. And these are the measurement results corresponding to that. These were simulation results. A and B were simulation results, C and D were agreeing experimental results. So that's how MyResonances were used as an example. Now let's continue with hybridization. We have zinc oxide nanobeams on top of crystalline silicon layer. The researchers investigate the scattering properties of these scatterers. So for very tiny materials, that doesn't really give us a good efficiency, scattering efficiency. By the way, this is sun's spectrum at the back. From going to that to 275 nanometer scatter with that size, our efficiency is tremendously increased. So that's why the researchers selected to work with a better, bigger scatterer. Once they put the scatterer on top of the flat layer, as you can see, we arrive at these peaks that we also covered in our own discussions. And the enhancement from the bare silicon is around 87%. This is the result for bare silicon. And if you put the nanowires on top, TCO nanowires, then you get an 87% increase. Okay, so what kind of modes did they use to increase the light trapping efficiency? The first one they discussed is the MyResonance again. Throughout the spectrum here, the MyResonance is staying fairly constant regardless of the pitch length, that is the periodicity of the unit lattice. They have changed it from 1047 to 314. The MyResonances stayed almost the same. Why? The MyResonances are dominantly related to the nanostructure themselves, and they're not really coupled to the other resonators. These separate resonators are acting independent of each other. Hence, we see the MyResonance standing throughout the change of the pitch length. Whereas, the same experiments, the same investigation has been carried out for other modes. While we're carrying, increasing or decreasing the pitch length, we have these curves coming in the picture, and these are nice dispersion curves that we covered. For example, D, this curve, is represented here. The electric field plots are represented here. It's obviously not a wave-guided mode because the absorber here is this 15 nanometer silicon absorber, and that's the scatterer that we have. In the mild mode, we had all of the mode inside, as you can see. But here, we have leakage. This looks something very similar to what we already covered. Yes, the Bloch waves. So, D is a representative of the Bloch waves inside the structure. And of course, the photonic crystal Bloch waves will be altered if we change the periodicity. And E, the last one, that's a wave-guided mode, as you can see. It's confined roughly in the slab, the flat slab, and it's a traveling mode rather than the others. So my mode was confined inside the nanoscatterer, but waveguide mode, on the other hand, is confined within the waveguide, as expected. The my mode was still enabling some absorption because of the leakage, again, from the zinc oxide layer to the ultra-thin 50 nanometer silicon layer. And here's another example regarding the plasmonics. So in this case, we have a discontinuity in the metal. So we have, again, backscatterers, just like the case we discussed a couple of slides back, made out of metal. In this case, it's silver. And on top of it, we have our absorber. And it's actually domes one after another placed on top of each other. And this is an FESEM photo of the structure, overall structure. And this is a side view of the structure. All of these sides, they have different solar cells with different parameters corresponding to different colors. So they different parameters make them alter their reflection coefficients, and then we see them with different colors. Okay, so they compare two cases, the periodic configuration and the random case. In this structure, we have fully periodic nanodomes, whereas in this structure, as you can see, we just have a rough surface with random gratings or diffractor scatterers. So this is the response of the flat reference. As you can see, it can go up to almost 11 milliamperes. But once we put the nanodome, it once again enhances the absorption, and in turn, it increases the short circuit current. The short circuit current that we get is around 14 milliamperes in this case for an absorber thickness of 340 nanometer. So the researchers investigated two different absorber thicknesses. In this case, they investigated the case in which they had 160 nanometers of 160 nanometers thickness of amorphous silicon. And they also varied the periodicity. As you can see, we have lower short circuit values around 10 or 12 milliamperes, and that's expected because we have fewer amount of absorber in the material now, from 160 nanometers to 340 nanometers. The volume of the absorber is decreased, but still we're doing pretty good on top of the flat layer. And if you pay close attention, Here we have the random structure, the black curve. The blue one, the periodic structure, is doing much better than the random structure. But the one with a bigger period, 700 nanometer pitch, is doing a worse job. And now we're looking at the total absorption inside the absorber material. Here in this part, it was about short wavelength responses. And in this part, as we discussed, it was about long wavelength responses. So in this part, we need to remember that for amorphous silicon, we need to have something L equals L touch, close to L equals L touch. And strikingly, the blue one gave a better result because that has a smaller period. And here, on the other hand, we can have different forms of light trapping. In this case, we're working with plasmonics, and they will come into picture as a parameter of the periodicity again. This is the measurement, and this is a simulation result. The orders suggest that in this long wavelength part, there are sudden peaks, as you can see here, that's magnified. And those peaks are corresponding to plasmonic modes. And in the measurement, as you can see, the 500 nanometer is outweighing the other results, especially the random structure. The random structure, on the other hand, has a smooth response. It doesn't have those sudden changes. Even 700 nanometer has some of those peaks. So let's compare the random structure here with the periodic structure. And this is for L equals 500 nanometers. And the thickness of the absorber is 160 nanometers. So we're approaching at different angles to the structure, at normal incidence, at different incident angles, theta. This is that axis. By changing that, we're actually able to couple to different nodes with the help of diffraction and plasmonics together. So the diffraction helps us to couple to different tangential component of the k-vector. And at some point, those components, tangential components, can be equal to the plasmonics, the tangential components of the surface plasma polaritons. Once they are equal to each other, the tangential component coming from the diffractions and the tangential component of the surface plasma polaritons, once they are equal, the surface plasma polaritons are excited inside the structure. And the researchers divided these two, divided this to that, to arrive at these dispersion curves. And these are the dispersion curves corresponding to the plasmonic structures. And in the next paper, first the researchers carved out these valleys, and they deposited first their TCO and their absorber and a back contact buffer layer, zinc oxide thick buffer layer. And they compared it with these pyramids, random pyramids. And we also have the flat glass reference case for comparisons. Here is the result for the nanocavities that the researchers prepared. That's the black curve without the dashes. And the random structure is represented with the dots, the red dots, the pyramids. And as you can see, the total absorption inside the absorber is almost equal to each other. In other words, the absorption efficiency of the random and the periodic structure are almost close to each other. In the other case, the researchers also shown the flat response. Our response is much better than the flat response, without a doubt. But we also have an intermediate cavity formation in between, from the black one to the flat layer. Those are the smoothed cavities, as they call them. And that's the response of the smoothed cavities. Okay, here's a picture that we are now very much familiar with. So what they did is basically they treated the cavity, the grating as a perturbation, just like we did, and arrived at this conclusion. They treated as if they had a flat slab layer in the knee, and the small tiny bumps will be just introducing diffraction orders. And as you can see, we have first diffraction order here, the second one, and the third one. And the corresponding slab guided modes are computed here. Those are corresponding to these curves, the dispersion curves. And the intersection points with the dispersion curves will give us the number of modes. So, on top of it, researchers did another thing. They also calculated the angle and the efficiency of the diffraction orders. So, they shine the light experimentally, and they try to see the diffraction efficiency of these small gratings, and that's the amount they found for the first order, and the second order, and the third order. Lambertian reflector has the random shape. It is a diffuse reflector. You might remember it from our first lecture. And it is assumed to reflect the light in all angles equally. So as you can see, it is expected to create all different diffraction orders simultaneously. That's put there for a comparison. But unfortunately, the random structure, the pyramids here, they don't reflect the light. The random structure does not reflect the light with equal contribution to every angle. The Lambertian does that. The Lambertian scatters the light at every angle equally, while the random formation does not do that, does not scatter the light, diffract the light in all these different angles, but prefers the lower angles, and it dies out later on. And that's the reason why the outcome of the random structures and the periodic structures are so similar. If it were able to continue the nice angle efficiencies, angle scattering efficiency, the pyramids, if they could continue that, doing that, they would probably outweigh the performance of the periodic structures. And this is the scattering efficiency for our smoothed cavities, so they're smaller, as you can see. In the end, the nanocavities and the pyramids, their performance are on top of each other. So the researchers came to the conclusion that periodic structures can do as much as good as the nanocavities, and the flat response is here. And here's another study on photonic crystals this time. So we will be playing around with Bloch waves, as you might expect. So the photonic crystals are very ordered structures like this. And the randomized structure will have a shape like that. So researchers ask, what if we combine these two worlds? What if we meet at the intersection point in between? Okay. So first, they cover the slab with an anti-reflection coating. And here's what they get. The darker curve, the brown curve is what they get. Once they drill the slab to get the photonic crystal, then they achieve to couple to these Bloch waves that we discussed in the previous slides. And of course, they're coming up with these peaks, peak locations. But that is not really concluding our efforts. They want to introduce some sort of randomness into this very periodic structure of photonic crystal. So they do this. Instead of carrying out the periodicity, they don't drill at a certain point. They skip that point, and by doing so, they open up an opportunity to couple into more and more Bloch waves. So here is the here's the available modes for our original structure. So for the original structure at around 700 nanometers, as you can see, this is the case. We don't have those nicely guided modes. But once we introduce these defects, then this is what's happening. And that's why this region inside the small circle is brighter than the other one, the original structure's circle. Which means that we now have traveling coupled resonators on the surface of the photonic crystal, and we have basically more Bloch waves. And these coupled resonator structures are enabling us to increase our absorption efficiency. How? Very similar to what we did last time. We divide the these two curves. This is again the angle versus wavelength curve. We are approaching the structure at different angles so that we have the opportunity to couple the light at into more modes. These are the available modes that these structures can supply. Once we divide this to that, like this, we arrive at this conclusion that we have these coupled resonator modes that we don't see for the fully periodic case. So a super lattice, they call it a super lattice structure, is outweighing the performance of a fully periodic structure in this fashion. And if we combine it with a random structure on the top, like this ARC material, a randomized textured structure, and a superlattice structure underneath a photonic crystal of superlattice structure, then you can get something close to the Yablanovich limits, as they claim. So they're basically, in summary, bringing the periodicity, the world of periodicity, together with the world of randomness. And this concludes our discussions and the lectures. Thank you for listening to me.